This is Interviews, a podcast from the National Academy of Sciences that provides first-person accounts of the lives and work of Academy members. In this series of one-on-one conversations, scientists talk about what inspired them to pursue the careers they chose and describe some of the most fascinating aspects of their research.
Helen Quinn is a professor at the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center. She's best known for her studies of unified gauge theories, the mechanisms to assure parity and combine charge conjugation parity conservation in strong interactions, and the study of CP violation in weak decays. She's interested in why the universe is dominated by matter, what are the differences between the laws of physics for matter and those for antimatter, and related questions. Dr. Quinn has been president of the American Physical Society and is a recipient of many honors and awards, including the 2000 Dirac Medal.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about your background. When you were a child, were there any scientists? I think I heard you mention your father was an engineer.
My father was an engineer. My mother was actually trained as a dietitian. Neither of them had college degrees, but they both had what was then like a technical school education, and they both were interested in science and interested in having all of the family talk about and puzzle around about mathematical puzzles or things like that that definitely were part of what we did as a family growing up. And playing games like checkers and chess and other kinds of challenges was sort of what the family did for fun.
Where was this?
I grew up in Melbourne, Australia. My family immigrated to the U.S. in 1962 when I was a college student.
And where were you ending up going to college when you came
in? Well, I had 2 years at University of Melbourne, and we came to San Francisco Bay Area. I knew absolutely nothing about the American education system, so I got a book, and I looked up what schools were close to where we were coming, and I found Berkeley and Stanford. So I applied both places. Stanford was much more generous about giving me credit for what I'd done in Australia, so I decided to go to Stanford. Part of this generosity was they gave me a year of credit for my last year of high school. So that put me in a position to have 1 year more as an undergraduate, which is what I would have had in Australia, and then stayed at Stanford for graduate school.
Had you already focused in on physics by then?
Actually, no. In Australia, I had a cadetship from the Weather Bureau. And had I stayed in Australia, I would be a meteorologist today. But they were paying my way through school, and I was bonded to work for them for 5 years after I finished my degree. Actually, an interesting side story to that was part of the bond was that I must not marry for the first three of those 5 years, because at that time the Australian government didn't hire married women. They couldn't have a married woman on a five-year commitment. So I couldn't marry until it was only 2 years, and then they could put me on a temporary position and kick me out at the end of it.
So you had to do this after your undergraduate?
So after my undergraduate, I was supposed to work for them for 5 years, but when I was 2 years into that program, my father was transferred or offered a position at the parent company of the company he'd worked for in Australia. And I went to them and told them the family was moving, and they released me from the bond. I think just the particular person I went and talked to was nice about and said, I think we can define this as circumstances beyond your control. And so I was released from that. But that meant I'd taken 2 years of science, math, sort of general science with physics, applied math, chemistry. You don't do general studies requirements in college in Australia, so you start right in. So I came to Stanford. I was more or less taking graduate level physics and math and freshman general studies requirements for my senior year at Stanford.
Was the atmosphere at Stanford conducive to studying physics? You got there and you realized this is really where you wanted to go?
It started out really as much I went around, sort of took my package and shopped it around to various departments, and it turned out the physics department was the easiest one to mesh what I had into completing their degree program. I think as much because one particular then assistant professor, Jerry Pine, who's now a professor at Caltech, looked at me, he looked at my record and said, look, if you think you've taken a course, you've taken it. If you think you need to have it, you take it. And that made it very easy for me to decide, you know, where to push myself, where to fit in and sort of take something over a bit to make the programs mesh, because they're really very different and the way they broke the subjects up are quite different.
But there weren't that many women.
There were very few. There was probably one other girl majoring in physics in that class that I became a member of, graduated with, and I think there were two girls entered graduate school with me, both of whom dropped out within the first year.
Did that surprise you when you came here that it was like that, or is it similar?
It's similar there. It's interesting. Because I was in a general science major, it wasn't quite so obvious. If I look back and I look at my advanced math classes and my physics classes, the ratio of women was small, but not quite as small. But I remember one time at Melbourne University walking into the engineering department, into the room where the students did their drafting practice, actually looking for my brother, and being hazed by the guys in the room because they weren't expecting to see women walking into that room. So the attitudes were there too. I think they came a little more strongly at me as I became a graduate student and not an undergraduate. And I just got sufficiently interested that I kept doing it anyway. Actually, when I applied for graduate school, I wasn't very confident about it. I thought, well, maybe I'll be a high school physics teacher. And I don't really need a graduate degree to do that. But I'd like to do a little bit more, so let's go for a master's degree. And then I looked and I found that the good schools didn't accept people who applied only for a master's degree. So I applied for a PhD, thinking, well, I'll just do the master's degree and then I'll leave. And so it was quite the opposite of the people who started out thinking they wanted a PhD and dropping out. I was very tentative about starting and got stronger and stronger in my resolve as I went along.
Well, that's a good thing. I mean, if you had decided and were dead set on just teaching, then you wouldn't have continued on into the work you did. So.
Right.
What did you do for your graduate studies, for your PhD studies?
It was particle physics. The Accelerator Center where I now work was just beginning to operate at that time. And actually my thesis advisor was one of the first scientists there.
Oh, who's
and
that?
His name's James Bjorkane. Everybody calls him BJ. And he was very much involved in the work which was the initial program of experiments there. He was the theoretician which really helped the experiment make sense of what they were doing. And so I worked with him as a graduate student and got really excited about what was going on there too, because it was a real discovery time, and that was a period where the work that won the Nobel Prize in 1990 was going on at that lab, and it was really opening up our ideas of what particles are made of.
So you got in at SLAC just as it was starting up, more or less.
Yes.
It must have been very inspiring.
I didn't. That was very exciting. Then, of course, I left and went off elsewhere for postdoc and came back some years later. But I did get excited about particle physics with the early work that was going on at SLAC.
What specifically were you doing?
My thesis was kind of technical issues, but in the physics of particles, there's a type of interaction called the weak interactions. And at that time, the theory of the weak interactions had a terrible disease. If you did the first approximation, you got good answers. But if you tried to do a higher order correction to that and make a more precise calculation, the calculation made no sense at all. It gave you infinity for an answer. So this was a time where ideas about how that theory worked were evolving. And my calculation was using some techniques called current algebra to explore in what circumstances you might get better answers at the next level up, and how you could see certain cancellations of these infinities if you looked for certain classes of theories. And that really was prior to, but leading up to, what we have as the current theory, which is a perfectly sensible theory, which in a certain limit is the old theory, but it's got pieces in it that the old theory didn't know about that fixed the problem.
How recently did it become fixed, so to speak?
It became the standard theory in the late 60s, early 70s.
This is the Weinberg and
Weinberg,
Salon.
Yes, right. So Weinberg's paper was actually 1962, which is before I finished as an undergraduate. The Weinberg paper, however, was published and ignored by the entire community until a paper in 1970, which introduced some new calculational techniques that made it possible for people to investigate that theory further. And in fact, the first higher-order calculation in Weinberg's theory I did with a couple of other people. By that time, I was at Harvard, and I was working with Tom Applequist and Joel Primack, and we did a one-loop calculation that showed, indeed, the infinities had gone away in that theory, at least at the next order up. And then other people took it and made a general proof of it to show that it was, indeed, a satisfactory theory. It didn't have this problem.
How can someone come to that conclusion, just from an outsider point of view, Weinberg already had the theory, but until you had this calculation.
Yes, it sounds strange when you don't know the way physics works. So a theory in the language of particle physics means that you've written down the mathematical formulation of something called the Lagrangian. The Lagrangian is basically the energy function of the theory. It's not quite true. The Hamiltonian is the energy function, but they're very closely related functions. It tells you how energy depends on all the variables in the theory. And the variables in the theory are the fields, and the particles are the quantum excitations of those fields. That's what's called field theory. So you can write down the Lagrangian for field theory. You can write down very complicated field theory Lagrangians, and then you have to go and do calculations to say, what do they predict? So when writing down this Lagrangian, Weinberg knew that his Lagrangian matched the leading order calculation of the old theory. That was obvious. But what he didn't know was how to do the next order calculation. There were mathematical tools that were missing. And he actually set a graduate student to do that problem, and the graduate student didn't succeed in making it work out, figuring out a way to do it. And so it was sort of put aside. And so everybody looked at Weinberg's paper and said, that's interesting, I wonder if it works. But nobody really investigated it further until in about 1970, a Tuft and Veltman came along and said, here's a way of doing the calculations that works for that class of theories. And then immediately, if you look at the references to Weinberg's paper, there's essentially none for many years, and then all of a sudden it takes off because people realized, oh, we can do the calculation, and yeah, that's the right direction for the theory to be going. There's another piece to it, too. Weinberg wrote his theory in 67. And he wrote it as a theory of leptons. That means he was doing the weak interactions of electrons and muons, but he didn't push it into the realm of the particles that we really are interested in weak interactions for, which is protons and neutrons. Right now, about 1964-65, the idea that protons and neutrons are made of quarks was coming along. By 1970, within the particle physics community, that was a fairly well-established idea. And if you took Weinberg's theory and extended it to the quarks, it made a lot of sense, right? And then you could do the whole problem of the weak interactions. So you had to take Weinberg's theory and add some pieces to it. And that's actually why there's more than one name. When you say call Weinberg Glashow Salaam, Glashow and Salaam had also tried slightly different variants of these ideas, and they'd been thinking of in terms of the quarks, particularly Glashow, from the beginning. So it all came together in a version of the theory that you had to do one more thing that seemed a little strange at the time. You had to add a fourth type of quark, where we only knew particles that came from the first three. You had to add the fourth type of quark to make the theory work. And that fourth quark was discovered about 1974. So the progression through those years from 67 to 74, from this theory being just a mathematical curiosity that Weinberg had written down but nobody was exploring, to being the accepted theory of particle physics for the weak interactions, depended both on experiment and theoretical developments over that time.
I think for a lot of people who don't know physics well, the idea of being able to just say, okay, there's a fourth quark, it's sort of either just baffling or just an amount of hubris to say, oh, well, okay, there's this other...
Absolutely, and even in the physics community that was true. A lot of people weren't willing to buy that it was okay just to invent a particle to get rid of a problem. I mean, this had happened already several times. If you look at the history of particle physics, probably the first time it happens when Dirac wrote down the Dirac equation, which explained the electron, it predicted antiparticles. It predicted the positron. It took several years for Dirac to admit that that was what his equation was predicting, because it was such a strange step to make, to say the mathematics says there's a particle there that nobody's seen. But in fact, so he wrote his equation in 28 or so, I think, and it wasn't until 32 that he said, first he said, well, this other particle has to be the proton, but the equation said the two particles had the same mass. And electrons and protons by no means have the same mass. Then people realized other problems. Eventually, by 1931 or 2, I think, Dirac says, no, if this other particle is really an entirely new thing, if it exists. So he wasn't even willing to say it exists.
Careful.
And then 1933, it's found. So it again, there was a progression. So it wasn't the first time that it happened. And then the next one was the neutrino, because when you have a weak decay, a neutron turns into a proton, an electron, and if you add things up, you don't get conservation of energy, you don't get conservation of momentum, you don't get conservation of angular momentum. And so you either give up three extremely well-established and fundamental conservation laws of physics, or you say there had to be something else. In this case, it was Pauli who was the one who said there had to be something else. The neutrino suggested it. And that became the observations, again, pushed in the direction that was the correct answer. It took quite a long time before somebody could actually observe it. So the same thing with this theory. There were the people who were really playing with the theory and investigating it were the ones who said, well, maybe this is the right direction to go, to add this particle, because it just seems to make the theory make sense. And many people said this. We don't really think quarks are that well established, although the experiments at SLAC that I talked about before, which actually established the existence of quarks, had happened in the late 60s. It really wasn't for quite a while that the community bought into the interpretation of them. And so I remember being in a room at Harvard. It was 1974, because my son was an infant in the room. So I can date it easily by his when he was born. And there were maybe six of us in the room. And we were talking about this theory, which had this additional quark, which is called the charm quark. And Shelley Glashow, who'd been the one who had proposed the idea of this additional quark, calling it the charm quark, he and Bjorkane, and then Glashow and others had developed it into this modern theory. He walked in and he listened for a while and he said, "You mean to tell me I'm in a room full of people, all of whom believe in quarks?" And there were six of us. That was May. 1974, November, the fourth quark was discovered. And it was a very dramatic discovery, probably one of the most obvious, you know, here's something new hitting you in the face discoveries that has happened in particle physics. And so by the end of 1974, you could fill a lot bigger room with people who believed in the charm quark.
But it's funny that even with those precedents of these predicted particles, that it's still difficult to get people to accept that.
You know, you had to change the paradigm. I mean, the whole paradigm of quarks was very different from everything that had come before. People had thought of neutrons and protons as being the fundamental things. And to give them a substructure, and a substructure which cannot be isolated. You cannot knock a quark out of a proton and see it by itself. And I think that was what made it very difficult to accept the idea of quark per se. And so that idea was still struggling for acceptance. And then to add an additional one that they'd been invented to explain all the existing particles, and all of a sudden somebody is saying, here's another one, and we don't know any particles that are made from it. That seemed like a bit of a push, at least to many people. To me, it seemed like, oh yeah, that really works. That makes sense. So why not go on that way? The community as a whole was skeptical about it. And there were degrees of that skepticism. There were people who rejected it completely. There were people, probably the majority, were kind of in a wait-and-see mode. And then there were the few of us who were taking it on as, well, maybe that's the right idea. Let's investigate further what that idea says.
You were at Harvard.
I was at Harvard at that time, yes.
When you get back to SLAC, you're still theoretical, but you're working with these experimentalists, which must have been somewhat satisfying to be able to see some of
it. It's fun to be able to be involved. I think my current role in the experiments that are happening at SLAC, so I'm not so active in them right now, but in the development of the experimental program and the development of the experiment, it was the first time I'd had the opportunity to really give input from the ground up how the experiment should be designed in order to measure the things that we wanted to see. What are the properties that the detector must have in order to be able to do all the things we want it to do? And then, you know, investigating the theory, what are the tests you're going to want to make?
So you actually get to take part in the...
In the early phase design.
The
early phase design, not really the construction, but the sort of the planning process and the idealization. You start off with a very ideal detector that can do everything you want, and then money and reality and the fact that the detector has to be held up, it doesn't just float there in space and so on, and you have to have space for the cables that take the signals out, and all of those things intervene between the theorist's ideal detector at the beginning and the real detector that gets built at the end. But it's a very interesting process.
How long were you away at Harvard?
So I completed my PhD at Stanford in 1967. And early 1968, I moved to Germany. My husband and I both had postdoc positions at Deutsches Elektron und Synchrotron, which is the high-energy physics lab in Hamburg, Germany. And we were there for 2 years. And then we came back to the United States. So in 1970, my husband was offered a job at Tufts, which is in the Boston area. And I said to him, look, if there's any city in the country where there's enough universities that I ought to be able to find a job, it's Boston, so accept the position and I'll look for a job in the Boston area. And I didn't find one. He was an experimentalist, so he had a job at Tufts in experimental high-energy physics. So we arrived in Boston. I had no job. The people at Tufts were very nice. They said, oh, we'll give you a desk. But I said, that's no way to make a career. And I thought of dropping out of physics. I took education courses. I did student teaching in a high school. I went back to my idea of being a high school physics teacher. So this is after a PhD and a postdoc. And at some point after I'd been in the high school, so this was 6 months, I also became pregnant with my first child. And I met one of the physicists I'd known at Stanford, who was now a junior fellow at Harvard, Joel Primack, who's a cosmologist nowadays, but then he was doing particle physics. And he said, oh, you should come to Harvard and talk to us, because you know, you're disconnected from everything at this point. And I said, oh, I'll come by sometime. But I really decided that I didn't want to spend the rest of my life in a high school. From the experience of doing the student teaching. I loved the teaching, I loved the kids, but I just didn't like the atmosphere. I didn't like supervising study hall and some parts of the job that didn't appeal to me. So I said, okay, I went back to Harvard and got myself an office in the Harvard Physics Department and worked my way back in to doing particle physics research again. And that was the time that this new technique for doing calculations just appeared. So I sort of jumped right into that area. And so my daughter was born in March, and shortly after that, which is rather late in the cycle for the way postdocs are hired in high-energy physics, the Harvard group got word from NSF that they had enough money to hire a postdoc for the next year. So they hired me for a postdoc position for the next year. So in that case, I got my job by being there and being actively involved with the people there. And so I stayed there as a postdoc, and I became then a junior faculty member at Harvard and stayed on. So I was 7 years at Harvard and finished up as an associate professor. And then my husband made a career change and got out of physics, and he got a job opportunity in California. So I had a Sloan Fellowship, a fellowship from the Sloan Foundation that I could use to support my research in any way. So I said, oh, okay, I'll take a leave of absence from Harvard and go back to California for the year. Go to Stanford, because his job was to be in the Stanford area, and we'll see how it works out. So then, realizing that that was working out for him and he wanted to stay there, I started looking around, and again, from being an associate professor at Harvard, I went to being a postdoc at SLAC again, because that was the job that was available for a year, and then that turned into a permanent staff position at SLAC. And I've been a staff member at SLAC until last August, when I became a faculty member.
You were working on the Weinberg calculations while you were at Harvard?
Yes.
And then when you came back over to Stanford during the period of time before you were back at SLAC, were you doing some work?
So let me explain the rest of what I did at Harvard. Yeah. I mean, this calculation that I mentioned is one of the things I did at the beginning of what I did at Harvard, but having started working on those kinds of theories, when working with Shelley Glashow and Howard Georgi, looking at how this theory of the weak interactions fits together with theories of the strong interactions, one of the very tempting ideas of particle physics in that period is something called grand unified theories. So there's the strong interactions and the weak interactions. When we write down these theories as field theories, Lagrangians, they have the same kind of mathematics. And so the tempting idea is that they're really different pieces of the same theory. And so that's called grand unified theory, that they somehow are unified into one theory rather than being just completely separate things. And one of the puzzles of that is, well, those ones are strong and those ones are weak. How can they be the same? And one thing we learned in that period is how the strength of an interaction changes as you do the interaction with different energies. And so there was a paper that I wrote with Howard Georgi and Steve Weinberg, which showed that if you looked at how the strengths of these interactions were changing, at some very, very high energy, they come together. And so the idea was that the unified theory exists at that very, very high energy scale. And then something happens that breaks it apart and it diverges. What happens is what's called the spontaneous symmetry breaking, which is fancy words for there are some particles in the theory that are massive. And if you're above the mass scale of those particles, then everything looks the same. But if you're below the mass scale, then that mass makes them look very different from the massless particles. And so the theory just looks very different looked at low energies and at high energies.
My very limited understanding of that grand unified theory was that they needed to put it together with the theory of gravitation in order for it to work.
No, that's not quite true. That's the next step one would like to do. So grand unified theory is an overstatement, if you like, because we haven't unified the theory of particles, strong electromagnetic and weak interactions, with the theory of gravity. And that still needs to be done. That's the goal of what's called string theory, which provides a mathematical formalism that seems to work for making that unification. Whereas the mathematical formalism of field theory, when you try to make that unification, you once again get this disease of infinities. It's called non-renormalizability, but the real fact of it is it gives you nonsense calculations when you try to do it, the higher order calculations. If you just try to put gravity into the formalism that we use for particle physics, it doesn't work. And so going beyond the grand unified theory to a theory which is the Einstein's dream of a unified theory, that would involve putting gravity in too. And there's certainly some progress in that direction, although there's no one version of a string theory that works in the sense that it has all of what we know about the field theory, particle physics theory, and the quantum gravity in a coherent formalism yet.
And even within the string theory, there were fourth or five or fifth, a whole bunch of versions. Now there's the M theory.
There's lots of different theories, but is this language of what you mean by a theory? When we say field theory, we're talking about a class of theories. And there was a hope at one point that when you said string theory, you were talking about a unique theory. But we now know you're talking about a class of theories. And then different members of that class may in fact be related to one another under this idea of M theory, because M theory is sort of one level further up still in a way. So the idea would be that the theory we know, we call the standard model of particle physics, the theory of the strong, weak, and electromagnetic interactions, would kind of automatically fall out. You wrote down the right string theory, you'd get the right field theory. It hasn't turned out that way. It doesn't appear that the formalism, which has the advantage of giving you a possible formalism for quantum gravity, will also have the advantage of predicting all the parameters that you need in the field theory to give you the particular field theory that describes the universe we live in. So we don't know, but we do know that the string theory formalism has within it a wealth of possibility. We certainly haven't ruled out that we'll find the right possibility within that formalism.
Is it sort of a different form of mathematics, a different mathematics?
It's a different underlying mathematics and a different conceptual basis. So I said in the field theory we have fields. A field just is a word for something which can exist everywhere in space and time. But it can be zero, or it can be non-zero and correspond to a particle moving through space and time. In some cases it can be constant everywhere and you can't notice it. The vacuum has non-zero value for some particular fields, because the vacuum is just the lowest energy state of the field theory. But the excitations are then essentially little point-like things. Now, in a string theory, the fundamental space and time is part of the formalism, as indeed it needs to be if you're going to bring gravity in, right? And so the notion of something existing in space and time isn't good enough to get you to quantum gravity. And you have to bring the space and time into the formalism itself, not just as a background in which the formalism plays out. And that, I think, is where string theory is really very, very different, because the fundamental objects which we can think of as little loops of string, not only do they define the particles, but they define the space and time too.
So that's a whole different way of thinking.
So it's a whole, you're right.
If you're dealing with standard model.
Standard model is a much less abstract, if you like. At least to me, it's so much more concrete. Well, I think people who do string theory visualize their field theory in a fairly concrete way, too, but it's much less related to the objects. What I do in field theory, what seems concrete to me, seems very abstract to somebody who hasn't seen the mathematics. And then there's a next level of abstraction that you go to with string theory. And a next level of mathematical complexity, too, I think.
That's funny you said visualize, because there's some sort of literal visual
thinking that goes on.
People give lectures like Ed
Yes, Whitten, they draw, or Brian Greene has wonderful graphics that go with it. No, it's definitely, a lot of physics is very visual in terms of how you think about it, too.
Your area where you were working at Harvard then was dealing with the zooming back out from the string theory and back.
Well, I was not ever in the string theory, and the string theory really hadn't begun in that period, too. It was field theory, and it was the grand unified theories, and this idea of how the coupling constants could come together, how the hierarchy of interactions that we see at low energy could evolve from a single type of interaction at high energy. That was the work I did there. That is one of my more famous, most cited papers. And then when I went to Stanford, I started talking with Roberto Pache, and one of the questions we began to talk about is, in this class of theories that come out of the grand unified theories, the strong interactions are a particular version of the field theory. And in that field theory, in what's now called the standard model, once you put the weak interactions in and have the particles all have masses, you find that the weak interactions have this feature of breaking CP symmetry, because we know by observation that we needed to put that there. But then, if you take the most general theory, that breaking of the symmetry between matter and antimatter, which is really what CP symmetry is, and it's got this extra P in it, but because that's the way the weak interactions work, but it's really the symmetry between matter and antimatter. That symmetry appears to be really very good for the strong interactions, because we look at certain properties of the neutron, magnetic properties of the neutron that would be there if there weren't a CP symmetry. And whatever they are, that the upper limits on having this property are very, very tiny. So we know that the CP symmetry of the strong interactions is very, very good. And in the class of theories we had, that wasn't automatic. If you put CP violation in the theory anywhere, it was likely to infect the strong interactions. And so what Roberto and I did was think about how can you get a theory where that infection doesn't happen, where it's natural as the theory evolves for it to come out in a way that the strong interactions are protected from the CP violation of the weak interactions. And we found a way of doing that. And again, that was actually a very visual process to think about it. I mentioned it's a disease that happens in a theory where particles have mass. But we know in the very early universe, when things were very hot, the particles didn't have mass. So the question to me was, okay, if the universe is cooling, how can I construct the theory so that as the universe cools, it will fall naturally into a situation where the strong interactions have CP symmetry?
Is this the antimatter?
CP symmetry is the symmetry between the matter and antimatter. But all we're talking now about is the symmetry of the strong interactions. When I say the symmetry, what I mean is a symmetry in the mathematical equations. And this symmetry is a statement that the mathematical equations for matter and the mathematical equations for antimatter look exactly the same, or in fact, like mirror images of one another. That's what CP symmetry is. It's the equations for matter and the equations for antimatter are just complete, exact mirror images of one another. Now, we know that's not the case. There's a small difference in those equations. They're just a little bit skewed from one another. But for the strong interactions, it is the case. For the strong interactions, the equations are just really good mirror images of one another. And so this work that I did with Pache was figuring out the class of theories, the types of theories in which that property that the weak interactions could not have CP symmetry, but the strong interactions could keep their CP symmetry. We figured out a way to do that. And that's what's called Pache-Quinn symmetry, which is we added another almost symmetry to the theory that protected the strong interactions.
So it's added into within the existing.
It's added into the mathematics. Mm-hmm. Mathematically, we added another kind of relationship, which had the property that it would protect this relationship for the strong interactions. And it actually has an interesting property, which we didn't notice. Weinberg and Wilczek actually were the ones who noticed it. It predicted the existence of a very light, very weakly interacting particle, which is one of the possible candidates for being the dark matter, all the stuff we don't yet see in the universe. It's not everybody's favorite candidate, but it's still there as one of the candidates.
It's just theorized now, or has it been observed?
It hasn't been observed. There's some people at Livermore doing experiments which are just beginning to reach the sensitivity with. If the theory is the way the most recent versions of it have it, they possibly will be sensitive to it.
When this type of thing comes up where you've got this now predicted particle, do the existing accelerators around the world have the capacity, or does there have to be new?
This particular particle is not one you can make in accelerators. It interacts too little with other things. Oh. So it would be a very, very rare process to make it in an accelerator. So you have to find a different way to look for this one. However, if it is the dark matter, then we're sitting in a galaxy, and this galaxy has lots of dark matter in it, so it's all around us, right? 90% of the mass in our galaxy is dark matter. So if you can find something that's very sensitive to it being there, it's there already. You don't have to make it. So that's the idea of the experiments at Livermore. They're building a cavity which is exquisitely finely tuned, resonant, in such a way that if an axion goes through that cavity, and if the axion has just the right mass, it will ring the cavity like a bell. And so it's a detector that's very finely tuned, but the way resonant cavities work is that the more sensitive they are, the more narrow the range over which they'll resonate. And so you have to make the cavity for looking for an axion at a particular mass, and we don't know what the mass of the axion is. So we have to tune the experiment over some range to do.
It's axion.
Yes.
So I remember Frank Wilczek, I'd spoken to him, and
yes.
He named it after a detergent or something.
Yes, actually, originally it had two names, and I liked the other one better. One of the names was the axion, and the other one was the Higlet.
Is symmetry a cause or an effect of this?
When we as physicists write down equations, they have symmetries if we put them there. So why do we want symmetries in our equations? There we go back to the great mathematician Emmy Noether, who told us that there's a relationship between certain kinds of symmetries in the mathematics and conservation laws. So for example, the fact that energy is conserved is related to the symmetry of the equations under displacements in time. And the fact that energy and momentum being conserved are related to the fact that the equations are the same at any place or time. The equations of physics don't depend on where you put the origin of your coordinates to describe space and time. They better not, because that would make no sense at all. That would say physics is different here and on the other side of the room. So we start off with the fundamental assumption that the laws of physics are invariant in space and time. We build that symmetry, that invariance under position, into the equations, because we think that's the way the laws of physics are. And then those equations predict a conservation law, conservation of energy, momentum, and angular momentum. So having built the invariances under position shifts, rotations of the coordinates, and origins of the time coordinate, we've got those symmetries in the equation. A symmetry and an invariance in the mathematics are the same, for in the physicist's language. When the physicists say symmetry, they often mean that the mathematics doesn't change as you change something. You can change variables in a certain way and the mathematics looks the same. It doesn't change the equations at all. So symmetries and conservation laws go together. So then very often what happens is we observe the conservation law. We observe, for example, that electric charge never disappears. That's an observational fact. And then we build that into the mathematics as a symmetry in the mathematics. And so it's a two-way street, if you like. Once you start realizing how valuable symmetries are in predicting, the point is conservation laws are very, very predictive, right? If you know what can't change, you've already constrained the situation a lot. And so the more things you know that don't change, the more you know about what's going to go on in a certain situation. So finding had the power of those symmetries in the mathematics, in these conservation laws, then makes them very, very attractive way to explain certain sets of observations. So it comes about, you observe empirically that there's some kind of conservation law, you build it in, in an equation, a symmetry in the equation. That's a statement about certain kinds of symmetries. The symmetries C and P that make the CP are not quite the same. They're discrete symmetries. There's, rather than having a whole continuous set of changes, we can just change particle into antiparticle or thing into thing in the mirror. So those are much simpler kinds of symmetries. They don't go along with these conservation laws, but once we've realized that symmetries in general are powerful things, we started to look at the discrete symmetries as well as the continuous ones and see. And there are some conservation laws that go with them. So if you have a system which turns into itself when you turn all the particles into antiparticles, so it's a system made up of an equal number of particles and their antiparticles, then saying there's a CP symmetry in the theory is predictive, because in quantum mechanics, signs make a difference. So it can turn into itself or it can turn into minus itself. Those two classes of things never get mixed up if CP is a symmetry. So it has some predictive power. And so that's why it's valuable to investigate the symmetries, to examine what are the mathematical symmetries. And it further turns out, when you write down a field theory, any field theory, no matter what, any theory that fits into this class of theories that we use to do particle physics, it automatically has the combined symmetry of CPT. C, particle into antiparticle, P, reversing all directions, so it's not quite really mirror, it's mirror plus rotation, and T, which is turning everything backwards in time, which, again, in the mathematics, you change the reverse the sign of time and the equations don't change. Or they change, but they change in such a way that when you reverse the directions, the times, and particle into antiparticle, the equations go back into themselves. And you cannot write a sensible field theory that doesn't have that property. So you knew that CPT was a symmetry, and so then looking at the pieces CP and T separately, or C and P, are all interesting things to examine about theories, which pieces of those are conserved where.
I assume that there have been attempts to write field theories that don't follow the properties you describe.
Dirac wrote down his equation. It has C symmetry, P symmetry, and T symmetry separately. It has all three of them, each one by one. And the C symmetry was a surprise because that was the first place the antiparticles appeared. I mean, up until that time, you had electrons and you had protons. And in fact, you didn't even know about neutrons at that time. So the notion that for every particle, there was an antiparticle, which meant another particle just the same except you reversed the charge. So for the electron, there's a particle which is exactly the same mass as the electron, except instead of being a negative charge, it's a positive charge. And for the proton, there's a particle which is exactly the same mass as the proton, except instead of being a positive charge, it's a negative charge. And in fact, the neutron has an antiparticle, and you can really only explain that when you get down at the level and look at what quarks they're made of. And all the quarks get reversed inside. The fact that they add up to zero in the neutron doesn't make the neutron and the antineutron identical. But all of these particles have matching particles of exactly the same mass, but reversing all the charges. So that's matter and this is antimatter. Okay, we just invented the names for them. Up until the time of Dirac's equation, matter meant all the stuff around us and it also meant everything that has mass. Now we know all the stuff around us is matter, but not everything that has mass is matter, because there's antimatter and it has mass too. And one of the big puzzles is, if the equations of physics are so similar for matter and antimatter, how come we live in a universe that's populated with matter but not with antimatter? We can make antimatter in the lab, so we know it really does exist and it really does behave very, very much like ordinary matter, except when matter meets antimatter, they can both disappear and you get just photons, just radiation. So if you're living in a matter world and you make antimatter, it goes away pretty quickly. If we were living in an antimatter world and we made matter, it would go away pretty quickly. But intrinsically, they're very, very similar. And our universe is very, very unbalanced. So that's the big mystery. We still don't know. What we know is that very early on, well, we don't know, our modern theories say that very, very early on, the universe, in fact, had equal amounts of matter and antimatter. And it's this imbalance, this asymmetry in their equations, the difference in their physics, somehow allowed them to get out of balance at a crucial point in the history of the universe where the processes that don't conserve the amount of matter minus the amount of antimatter stopped being probable. if we look today at low energy in the lab, we never see processes where if we make antimatter, we make an equal amount of matter. We don't make an equal amount of matter. They always come in pairs. So you never change the amount of matter minus the amount of antimatter. That always stays the same. Right? Well, if you have something that always stays the same, then you have to explain the imbalance between matter and antimatter as just being something that happened at the beginning of the universe. In these grand unified theories, and in other theories too, there are processes which can change the balance between matter and antimatter, which don't have that extra conservation that they never change the amount of matter minus antimatter. And so we think that in the high-temperature early universe, that balance could change, and therefore, by the rules of thermal equilibrium, they were equal. And then just at the stage where that ability to change them froze out, became very improbable, just at that stage, they also got out of balance. And we have a couple of scenarios for how that could happen, but we really don't know. But clearly, it has to depend. If the laws of physics were the same and they were equal, then they could never have gotten out of balance. So understanding the piece of the laws of physics, which is the difference between the laws of physics for matter and antimatter, is clearly connected to this question of how did the matter and antimatter get out of balance.
So that's sort of the
And that's right the now. Focus of what I'm interested in. I mean, that's the focus of the experiments looking at that in the quarks is the B physics experiments at SLAC. B is the name of one of the fifth type of quark. Actually, we talked about four. There's now five and six. And number five is the B quark or the bottom quark. And experiments for making particles, actually what you do is you make a particle and an antiparticle, one with a B quark and one with an anti-B quark. And you study tiny differences in the way they decay. Those are keys to testing our current understanding of the pieces of the theory that violate the symmetry between matter and antimatter.
Why is the B quark used particularly?
Because it happens to provide a very good laboratory. The first place we saw a violation of CP symmetry was in the decays of K mesons. And B mesons are in some way like K mesons. They're particles which are neutral but have a flavor because they're made up of a B quark and an anti-D quark. The B quark and the D quark have the same electric charge. So a B quark and an anti-D quark gives you zero electric charge. But it's not a particle and it's antiparticle. It's a mismatch in the type of quark. And that means it's going to decay by the weak interactions. And in looking at those various decays, as we understand the standard model and the quark theory, that's a place where the CP violation should show up. And because you can make the particle and the antiparticle in a state where they're really made exactly the same pairs of them all the time, you can really have a very sensitive way of looking for very small effects.
And it's within your technological means to do so.
Right, so that's the region to investigate it. There's actually a whole nother area now that we know that neutrinos have mass. The neutrinos have a similar set of possibilities for being the place where there is CP violation. And so when we're looking at what happened in the history of the universe, we don't know whether it was this CP violation or that CP violation, the one in the neutrinos or the one in the quarks, that is responsible for the matter dominance of the current universe. We have scenarios that work either way.
Weren't the neutrinos originally a candidate for dark matter, except that they were thought to have no mass, but then they found mass in them?
They don't have enough mass. They're a piece of the dark matter, in a sense, because they are massive particles. There's two reasons why they're not the dark matter that we know today. In some sense, they're related reasons. They don't have enough mass in the sense that if we calculate how many neutrinos we think are there, and give them the kinds of masses we think neutrinos have, that doesn't account for the amount of mass in dark matter. And second is, because they're so light, they're moving relativistically. And because they're moving relativistically, they're what's called hot dark matter, whereas particles which are a little bit more massive or produced in a little lower energy ways are called cold dark matter. They're moving slowly. If you start with a universe, which we know at the time that the light that's now the black body radiation started coming towards us, the universe was much more uniform than it is today. And it has all the little tiny fluctuations that a few parts in 10 to the 6th that we see in the black body radiation correspond to density fluctuations in the universe back then. So you sort of start with a universe with these density sub-fluctuations and you model the evolution of structure due to gravitational attraction of the dense regions for themselves collapsing. Well, if the particles that were in the overdense regions were moving fast enough, they get out of those regions before those regions collapse. So hot dark matter doesn't give you a universe that evolves to the one we see today. You need cold dark matter. You need heavier or at least non-relativistic particles being the dark matter. And so that's the direction of the modeling now, is to find candidates for the cold dark matter. And neutrinos make up a small fraction of the dark mass in the universe. They count for the overall density. When you're asking, is the universe flat or not, that's one of the components, is the neutrino component, but it's a tiny, tiny piece of the mass.
Your work makes it very apparent how interactive cosmology and particle physics.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm the particle physics piece of it, but a lot of my interest in why I'm interested in this particular question in particle physics is because it has a relevance for cosmology. And on the other hand, when I talked about the work I did with Pache, it was using the ideas of cosmology of how the universe evolved that brought us to the particle physics theory that's the candidate to explain this question of CP symmetry and the strong interactions.
Do you work with cosmologists at all, or interact with them a lot with your work?
Talk with them, not really work with them, but definitely contact and read. We have a new astroparticle institute at SLAC, so that's great for me, is to have all these people coming and talking about cosmology more and more. Definitely the interaction is a growing one.
And you think that's going to, in some way, steer certain experimental works?
It won't change the high-energy physics experimental work, but it will bring a different community into that campus. And already we have, indeed, quite an active group there because they came with postdocs. And so there's a lot going on there, a lot more talks, a lot more interaction between the theoretical physics people, particle physics people, and these astrophysics people. And so that's a nice thing to have.
What are you working on now?
Still mostly on the things to do with the bee factory. And just, I would say, in some sense, plodding along with ideas for how do you pull the last piece of information out of the data that we have there. What are the questions we can ask, and what are the things where we can expect to get answers with a reasonable amount more data?
Do you find yourself going down on a certain possibility and then it doesn't pan out? And if that happens, how far down do you go before you know it's not the right way?
Well, over the course of my career, the answer to that is certainly yes. I think every scientist goes down some dead ends. How often do you know, and how do you know? Sometimes you recognize it early, sometimes you waste a lot of time. And at the moment, I think what I'm working on is a fairly well-developed field, so it's more a matter of really trying to refine. The challenge for doing the bee physics is, what we want to understand is the weak interaction physics, but we're dealing with particles that are made up of quarks. That means they have strong interaction physics too. And sometimes the ability to extract the information about the weak interaction physics is masked by the things we can't calculate about the strong interaction physics. And so the question is to find those ways of putting the pieces together that are least sensitive to the uncertainties brought about by the strong interaction physics. That's the kind of thing I spend my time thinking about.
You also do a lot of educational and outreach.
Right, and I'm currently president of the APS, so that's taking a lot of my time too. It's a 43,000 member organization, so.
So how do you see your field now? I mean, we had talked a little bit before we began taping this about women in the field and how few there were, and now it's a little better. Is there any effort to try to get more women recruited and to keep them in?
The American Physical Society has a committee called the Committee on the Status of Women in Physics. They also have an equivalent one, the Committee on the Status of Minorities in Physics, that takes on that task, and it's sort of a rotating group within the community. But I think a lot of it has to do with just slight changes in the style of the way the community operates can make the community much easier for women to make their way in. And there's kind of a critical mass phenomenon. I'm not sure where the critical mass is, but communities that have a significant number of women in them, women find it easier to then join in or become part of it. And I think different subfields of physics, different physics departments, are at very different places in that. And the ones that are kind of further down the road can offer suggestions that help. So part of what I see a role of APS is that kind of networking between departments that shares information or passes it on from people who've already tried something to people who are thinking about what should we do about this. and trying to make the process of learning a little more efficient. I think another one of the reasons I've been involved in education, I think education is critical, and how teachers think about educating kids are critical. So one of my roles as a role model is to be, for the physics teacher, a role model of the successful woman physicist. Because I think sometimes it's the prejudices of the physics teacher as much as of the professional physicists that discourage kids from going in. Math and physics teachers are critical at high school in terms of will girls go in those directions or not. And I think the teaching profession has, over the past, let's say, 20 years, become more self-conscious about that and more aware that what they're doing makes a big difference in terms of the gender choices. So it's changed a lot, and the high school physics teachers used to find it acceptable to discourage girls, and now they know it's not. Some of them still do it, but I think there's been a very big change of pattern there, and you see it in enrollment in high school physics classes. It's changed a lot, and so one hopes that will propagate on up through the system. It takes a long time to change the top. You have to work from the bottom up.
And the teachers are sort of at the base.
And the teachers are one of the keys to that, and teachers even in elementary school, and their teachers' attitudes. I remember years and years ago, I was talking about women in physics with a group of physicist colleagues over dinner. And one of them had raised the question, why are there so few women in physics? And we talked for a while. And then as conversation went on, and we started talking about the Exploratorium in San Francisco. And one of the people who'd been so concerned about why there's so few women in physics said, oh, I've heard that's a great museum. I must take Peter to it. And I said, that's why there are so few women in physics. And he said, what do you mean? I said, you have a daughter too. And it wasn't until I said that, that it registered that all this conversation we had before was relevant to his daughter as well as to this abstract case of why there's so few women in physics. And then we went down the list. You know, Peter had been given a chemistry set, and Maria had been given a weaving loom for Christmas, and all this stereotyping that parents do. And so all of that has to change before there's going to be anything like equity in terms of number representation in physics. And, you know, there may be, I'm open to the possibility that there are intrinsic genetic differences. There certainly are in many things. We were talking about behavioral ones earlier today. There may be even genetic differences in, say, ability to conceive abstract concepts mathematically. But if there are differences, the difference between the peaks of the distributions is much less than the widths of the distributions. And so there are many girls who are much better than many boys at these things, even if the peaks may be slightly different. And so I think it's the wrong question to ask. Are boys on average better than girls on average? It has to do with each individual's talents and interests and desire to pursue something. And a lot of that has to do with just what are you exposed to.
I mean, there's so many drop-off points from...
Yes. You know, what are you exposed to in terms of encouragement, and what are you exposed to in terms of discouragement? And every woman in physics in my age can tell you the horror stories of when somebody said something to them that was very discouraging. But I think that happens a little bit less now. I hope it happens a lot less, but I'm not sure.
So that's part of the APS's...
Part of the APS's role mission is to provide the role models for how it ought to be happening, or to, you know, for example, to put out a poster that says physics in your future that has girls in the pictures.
And also for the general public, because, I mean, I've heard comment from physicists that's become very biology-centered. Science is, you know, everybody loves biology, medical science, and physics has lost a little bit of the interest of the public. To keep people interested in it, to make them realize it's important, and some of these problems seem more abstract to people, so how do you keep them engaged?
Well, I think you engage different people with different things. My test is the airplane conversation. If you sit next to somebody on the plane, often I don't feel like talking and I just read my book and there's no conversation. But if I want to, I find almost anybody that I start talking to about what I do is interested and asks questions, and the conversation will continue from coast to coast. So I don't think people are not interested. I think they never have had a chance to explore, and they don't even know what questions are interesting. And we as physicists tend to do a very poor job of sort of a general communication of that. But one-on-one, I find, you know, you listen to what the person is saying and asking, you can find the way to relate that to what the research is and what's interesting about it. And most people will get engaged and try to understand and want to know. I think it's rare to come across somebody who says, a lot of them say, oh, I wasn't very good at physics in school. And my typical reaction to that was, well, it probably wasn't very well taught, because it's probably true. And you go on from there. And very few people will just turn it off and say, I'm not interested in that.
Well, it's kind of like the stereotype working right. against you, except in this case, the stereotype of physics just being too much for the average human to understand.
Right.
Puts the average human in this position of thinking, I'm going to look really stupid if I
ask questions about this. Right. And so you have to kind of expect that and work through that. But then the interest is there.
Well, the whole sociology of the field, right. too. I mean, I think scientists have become much better at communicating to the public and wanting to.
Some of us.
Some. But realizing that it's important.
Yes. You know. I think the community as a whole knows more that it's important now than it tended to be a feeling of, we don't need to explain it to them. They just need to give us the money and we'll do it. Yeah. That doesn't really work. And we know it now.
Since 1863, the nation's top scientists have been honored with membership in the National Academy of Sciences. Today, there are more than 2,500 in the NAS membership, of whom approximately 200 have won Nobel Prizes. We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Interviews and invite you to join us again for another inspiring conversation.